This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and you are tuned to your Community Connection, KBOO Boardland, 90.7 here in the city. If you are listening in the Gorge, it's 91.9. And if you're listening in the Valley, it's 100.7. And in the ether, that being the air, you can stream KBOO at kboo.fm. Tell your friends far, flung, and wide.
We welcome you and thank you for joining us today. Today is May 15th, 2010. On Thursday, May 19th, will be the 86th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm Little, known to many of us as Malcolm X. He has been the subject of much conversation and is the subject of a recent book by Manning Marable entitled A Life of Reinvention, Malcolm X. We will talk about the book today with an editor of the book, Kevin Dalton, who is an editor at Viking Penguin. The author of the book, Manning Marable, who was a prolific writer and scholar, died shortly before the publication of this book. He spent many years researching this book, and since the publication of this book, we have had the opportunity to engage in meaningful conversation with many people about this book and about the subject. We welcome your participation in our conversation this morning, and we thank you for joining us, Kevin, this morning.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Cecil. Celeste?
Yes, good morning.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it was fascinating to open the book and to read it, but I thought we might begin by just talking about Mr. Marable, and perhaps you can tell us in terms of your work with him and how this book came about.
Well, this was a subject that had long fascinated Manning since his youth, and I think I want to just start by saying that it's for each time that one of us who's been sort of pitching in Manning's absence, we wish he could be here talking about the book.
I can imagine.
He's far more eloquent and deeply knowledgeable about it than any of us. It was a lifelong project in some sense. I think he was someone who was touched by Malcolm very early on, and the ideas for the book, or for doing sort of a big biography about Malcolm, started at least a couple decades ago for him, and sort of moving through, putting together all the information, clearing through any number of previously written books, finding and conducting all sorts of new interviews, and digging up research and looking at documents that people really just hadn't seen before. Government files or Nation of Islam files. It was an ongoing project for Manning, and I, as one of his editors, have been amazed that he had a very full career alongside of it. Mm-hmm. But it was something that I think when it finally came out and he was able to hold a finished copy of the book and see it before he passed away, and so I do feel like. It does represent a very significant part of what will be his legacy.
Yes. The focus of our discussion this morning is on Dr. Marable's book, Malcolm X. Perhaps at another time, though, Manning Marable was an influential scholar and activist in of himself, and I think at some point in time, maybe we should have a larger discussion on Mr. Marable's legacy.
I think that would be a wonderful idea. In the time that I spent working with him, it was a great pleasure to work with really just one of the most respected and distinguished historians and thinkers of the last 20 or 30 years.
We'd had the pleasure of interviewing him some time ago, and so it would be nice to follow that up. I also, maybe a little later on in the program, wanted to touch on Dr. Marable's companion and wife, Leith Mullins, who also helped him with the book. with regard to her ability maybe to move some of the ideas and the energy that were put forth in the book forward, if you have the opportunity to comment.
Oh, sure. I mean, I can talk about that now or later, whenever you like. I mean, Leith is wonderful and brilliant in her own right, but I'd let her speak for whatever sort of her future plans are concerning Manning's legacy on the book.
Well, let's start by talking about, as you mentioned earlier, what captivated Dr. Marable regarding Malcolm X. What was it that set him on fire?
Well, I think that there were, I think that he came to Malcolm X the way many of us have through the autobiography. And I think as time went by and he began to do more research into Malcolm, he began to see that since Malcolm's death, many different sort of people and sources this myth had grown up around him. And the more he looked into it and the more he studied Malcolm's life, I think he saw this divergence, in a sense, between what Malcolm had done in his life and who he was and how he had presented himself in the autobiography. And as I think that as he dug deeper into this, he began to see a much more complex and multifaceted figure, I think, than the myth of Malcolm has come to show. And I think that once he began talking to people who had known him and bringing a lot of this information together, I think that it really set the ball rolling for him.
So Mr. Marable's one of his purpose was to clarify the myths, to debunk some of the myths, to present a more holistic picture of Malcolm X?
I think that's true, but I also think in some ways it was bigger than that. I think that he really did see Malcolm as the towering figure he was, and that to be fair to him, he deserved the same kind of treatment that we give to all of our sort of major historical figures, to sort of present him not just as a mythical portrait, but as a man in full, with all of his strengths and all of his flaws, and to see how those things shaped his thinking and changed the way that he presented himself to the world.
In approaching such an iconic figure, I assume that Mr. Marable was aware of the potential minefields he needed to negotiate in terms of presenting a picture that was honest and complete, but also paying, being sensitive to people's feelings. For such an iconic figure, where everyone from Dan Quayle to black nationalists claim as someone they admire, are you aware of if Mr. Marable was concerned about stepping on toes or other people's responses to what he would uncover?
Well, I think he was a very sensitive and thoughtful individual, but he was an incredibly well-trained historian. And, I think at the end of the day, he sort of understood, in a sense, that when you have a figure who, even in the past 40 years since his death, has been as controversial as Malcolm was, you're not going to be able to write a good book about him that isn't both honest and, in a sense, controversial in itself. And I think that he was very aware that there are many different groups of people who claim Malcolm as an influence, and that many of them have seen Malcolm through a different lens, whether it's a political lens or a racial lens or a class lens. And I think that, in trying to be all-encompassing and in trying to really set down a complete picture, he knew he was going to have to challenge some of those ideas. And I think as the great historian he was, he felt like it was his duty to challenge those ideas where the things that he found did actually challenge them.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. We are speaking with Kevin Duden, who is the editor at Viking Penguin, about the new book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Dr. Manning Marable. We're going to open up the phone lines here so that you can join us and have conversations. And we invite people to ask questions about the rich life of Malcolm X, as well as any questions you may have about how Dr. Marable, Manning Marable, approached his venerated subject. 503-231-8187. And we invite new callers especially to call in. To get back to thinking in terms of navigating a minefield, not even a potential minefield, but an actual minefield, there are those who are caught off guard maybe by some of the points in the book that maybe cast Malcolm in such a different light that the information almost might be ill received. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more prominent points in the book that have been a little either controversial or just stood out prominent?
In terms of some of the things, I mean, I think that I could start with one thing, and we can certainly talk about any number of them. But
example, his criminal record.
Well, the criminal record is a great place to start, and that's actually where I was headed. When you read the autobiography, there's this picture of Malcolm sort of presenting himself as sort of a more hardened criminal, someone who was steeped in the streets. And to an extent, as Manning dug into sort of the real life facts of his past, he did find that Malcolm was very steeped in the streets. But what he also found was that he had, in many ways, when talking to Alex Haley and putting together the autobiography, he had exaggerated a lot of his criminal exploits. He had made himself seem, in some sense, a bit tougher and a bit more criminal than he actually was. And he did this, Manning argues, in service of trying to create in the autobiography the most compelling narrative of awakening and of transition that he could deliver. When he was writing the early stages of the autobiography, he was still a part of the Nation of Islam, and so he was very concerned about the way that he was going to present the effect that the nation had on his own life in his transition, that happened in prison for him. And I think one of the things that becomes clear in reading Manning's book is that Malcolm felt that the best way to show the overwhelming effect that the nation has had in his life was to build up his reputation as more of a hardened street criminal, to sort of create a more powerful effect of actually being converted. So I had gone from being, he would say, this bad, and this is the narrative of my life, and you can see at this moment of conversion that this was what saved me. And certainly when you're looking at his conversion, it certainly had a profound and tremendous effect on his life, no matter what transgressions his youth had found him committing.
Let me ask you something here. You tell us one or two of some of the points, maybe specific points where he embellished? Because there's a thought, well, we know he had an arrest record. Many people have seen the mug shots, and
right,
they've heard his stories of being a drug runner and a pimp and whatever. But in what specific areas can you point out, perhaps, where he embellished his criminal record?
Sure. Well, one of the things that he, when he was talking about his early life in the autobiography, is basically talking about sort of breaking and entering, talking about robberies, and there seem to be just a lot fewer of these than he actually sort of claimed to have done. And even beyond that, there are a number of things, sort of real life incidents, that sort of just give the lie to the sense that he was a more hardened criminal. When he was home visiting family in Lansing, he sort of very awkwardly tried to rob a friend who immediately turned him in, and it caused more trouble for him in the Detroit area than he possibly needed. Generally, it seems that he was just much less active as a criminal, as someone who was breaking and entering into homes, as someone who was involved in violent crime. From what Manning turned up, it doesn't seem to be very much of this at all.
Well, this raises a point in terms of the purpose and of the autobiography of Malcolm X. Now, again, we have a somewhat similar situation with this book. The autobiography of Malcolm X was published after Malcolm X's death, and certainly I would assume Malcolm was he able to read the final copy of the autobiography?
Was Malcolm? No, he was not.
He was not.
He was not, and you know, one of the things that really, one of the things that excited Meng, to sort of go back to one of your earlier questions, is that in the course of his research for the book, he had found a set of chapters that seem to have been intended for the autobiography, but that were never actually included in it. And these were chapters about Malcolm's evolving political views at the time that he was leaving the Nation of Islam. And these chapters never made it into the final manuscript. And what actually, you know, what actually sort of happened was that Alex Haley wrote a very long piece at the end of it that seemed to locate Malcolm more firmly in the tradition of Martin Luther King. And I think this was something that, you know, that Manning, having delved very deeply into Malcolm's political evolution, just saw as Alex Haley's way of shaping and presenting Malcolm differently than he would have presented himself at the time of his death.
So certainly Alex Haley, as a black liberal Republican, had an agenda and a mission in and of itself.
He did.
And also related to Malcolm's history and life story, I think one thing I gleaned from Mr. Marable's book, that, and it's been some time since I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, was how his family background in terms of devotion to black nationalism and Garveyism. So it seems as if in this book, it's clear that he comes from a history of radical activism that I'm not sure came across as clearly in the autobiography.
No, that's certainly true. I mean, his father was from Georgia, and he had met Malcolm's mother in the course of, I believe, I'm blanking just momentarily, I believe they might have met in Montreal. They eventually settled in Philadelphia, and then they moved out west to Nebraska. I mean, they were really sort of all over the country in the service of Garvey, in the service of, you know, trying to start Garveyite branches all over the country, and that was something that his father was involved in when they got to Michigan, where, you know, sort of most of Malcolm's young life transpired. And Malcolm would accompany his father to these sort of group meetings, and he would see his father speak in front of crowds. And so this was something, I think, that took hold of him very early.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. Our guest is Kevin Dalton, who is an editor at Viking Press, and we have an opportunity here to speak with him about the book written by the late Dr. Manny Marable, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone number is 503-231-8187. And we're going to go to our caller, Joanne. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't like being first callers, but blessed be for this program. I'm going to try not to cry. Blessed be for this program and for Manny Marable. Part of me is angry and feeling sad that we have, for generations, been deprived of information about Malcolm X, and I want this information in all the schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne, for your call. One of the points I think Joanne made was the sense of needing the information out, getting the accurate information about Malcolm X to next generation. Was it the hope of Mr. Marable in writing this book that that more people, the next generation, will have a clearer understanding of Malcolm and get some clear directions in terms of how to create a political movement?
Well, let me jump in there really quick and ask, expand on this question.
Sure.
Also, the autobiography is taught as a text.
Yeah.
And so is the thought that this either augments or complements or maybe to some degree contradicts or at least just raises more informed discussion about how to move forward from the legacy of Malcolm X?
I think all those things are true. And I know that Manning never imagined that this would be a book that would in any way replace the autobiography. I mean, the autobiography is an incredible piece of literature. I mean, it has stood the test of time for all the right reasons. I think that one of his goals here. And I know that one of the great things that we've heard, certainly since the book has come out, is not so much high school teachers yet, although I imagine we will, but certainly a lot of college professors who are now saying that they would like to teach this book alongside the autobiography. And I think, you know, that is, I think it's a great idea. I mean, I think it's something that that I know would have made Manning incredibly happy. Because in some ways, you know, he never saw his work in this book. He never saw his goal here as in any way diminishing Malcolm or in any way detracting from the autobiography. I think his goal was to enlarge Malcolm, you know, quite the opposite, and to bring out all of his contradictions, and to see, and you can even see in the difference between the life he lived as described in this book and the life he lived as he described himself, you can learn more about him just through that, in terms of getting understanding of how he viewed himself, which is something that we rarely get a chance to see.
Something that comes out in the autobiography, but also in this book by Mr. Marable, is the conversion to Islam, or I guess originally to the Nation of Islam, in prison. I'm still struggling, because when I read Mr. Marable's book, it also seems as if it's like a sudden night and day conversion. Could you explain, you know, when he was in prison, mm-hmm. what were some of the factors that led to his conversion and radical shift, and it seems to be in his thinking? Certainly he had his family, some family members urging him to convert, but it seems as if even in this volume that there was a radical change in his thinking.
Well, especially since his prison nickname was Satan because he was anti-religious.
I think that there is. It's a great question, and I think that one of the things that Manning was looking at when he was looking at Malcolm's time in prison, and then he was looking at his conversion, and that I think does get built up to an extent in the early part of this book, is how important family was to Malcolm, and I think to an extent in looking at the conversion, I think you have to look at it as a kind of convergence of a number of different circumstances. The first being a kind of bottoming out personally for Malcolm, of being in prison, not being able to sort of to figure out how to sort of cope with the tremendous anger that he obviously had. I mean, he was constantly getting criticized on work shifts. He was not a model prisoner in a sense. And at the same time, to look at the way that he had stayed connected to his family through his youth, even through the days when he was living a kind of vagabondish existence in New York and traveling and working on trains between Boston and New York and Washington, D.C. He always found time to communicate with, to correspond with his family. So when he was in prison, and multiple family members came to him explaining that they joined the Nation of Islam, I think the ability to sort of connect to his family on that level was something that was tremendously important, and something that made it all the more difficult for Malcolm ultimately to be rejected by his brothers later on when he broke from the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. Feel free to join in the conversation as we discuss Dr. Manny Marable's book, A Life of Reinvention, regarding a deeper analysis of the life of Malcolm X. 503-231-8187. Ask questions to Kevin Dalton, either of Dr. Manning Marable's effort to write the book, questions about material found in the book, or questions about Malcolm X and his life. 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Kathy. Good morning, Kathy.
The autobiography, by the way, I read it about 3 or 4 times. I remember reading in the New York Times maybe 5 years ago or more that Malcolm's widow Betty died in a fire set by their grandson, an arson fire. Mm-hmm. And there was a suggestion in that long New York Times article that Malcolm himself may have set fire to his house in Queens, and that his father may have actually set fire to their house in Michigan, which that fire being blamed, I think, on the Klan. Has this been discredited, or does the book cover any of this?
Well, yeah, it does on a number of occasions. To start with, the fire at the Littles' home outside of Lansing in Malcolm's childhood, there certainly were sort of rumors floating around at the time that Malcolm's father had said it. But from what Manning looked at in terms of newspapers, oral histories, really digging into the history of that time, he came away believing that Earl Little, Malcolm's father, had not set the fire; that in fact it had been set by malevolent forces who were trying to threaten and harass them. And that's on that fire. In terms of the fire at Malcolm's own house in Queens, it seems pretty clear at this point that the Nation of Islam did set that fire. I mean, Manning spoke to one of Malcolm's closest associates from his time when he was in the Nation, who basically corroborates the fact that the Nation of Islam set the fire at Malcolm's house in Queens.
I'm wondering why. I mean, those are really, you know, painful allegations, especially in view of that tragic death of his widow Betty. Why the reporter? Where did those ideas come from, or why were they printed? Or,
well, Malcolm, for most of his life, certainly, you know, in his childhood, with the question of his father setting fire to their home, was certainly a different time, and Malcolm's family certainly was not going to get the benefit of the doubt in that case. They were a poor family. They had long struggled, and people were just not inclined to look at them with open eyes and sort of to see that in all likelihood that there were people who were very interested in pushing them out of town. Now, as to the later firebombing of Malcolm's house, and Malcolm had always had his share of run-ins with the NYPD, and at the time that his house was firebombed, the Nation of Islam, they were no friend to him either. So it was certainly in their interest to promote this idea of Malcolm as a sort of rogue actor who was framing them for burning his house. But it's just the truth just turns out to be entirely different.
Well, just to also flesh it out, Kathy, think of it. We're talking about a black man in America, mm-hmm. and referring to his father,
right,
who was not only a lay minister but was a Garveyite.
Yeah.
And so the attitude for lots of white Americans, especially when you look at the way that Malcolm's mother had been committed, was that any black person who had any issue with America had to be mentally ill or a troublemaker. And
no,
so,
that's exactly
yeah,
right. And these,
yes,
these allegations followed Earl Little, Malcolm's father, right up to his death. When what seems increasingly clear from the evidence, as Manning presents it, his father was killed and thrown under a streetcar. And yet, in terms of the way that the case was actually looked at the time, most people were just willing to think it was an accident, even though his father had been going out that night to collect some money for a job he had done. But his body was found halfway across town, or just on the other side of town. It just didn't really add up. But Celeste, you're right. I mean, he was living in a time where people weren't particularly keen on looking at the evidence as it existed. They were looking to it to fit the story that they wanted to have.
I understand entirely what you're saying. I'm just curious about why the New York Times printed that, or if it had been questioned.
Well, but the paper record.
Well, the New York Times wasn't necessarily a friend of Malcolm's either, if you look at his obituary, what they ran. But let's see.
It was only M.S. Handler, the reporter that Malcolm befriended, who did give him a fair shake. There were very few people in the mainstream press who were willing to give Malcolm a fair hearing pretty much throughout his life.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Early on, speaking of Malcolm, early on in his life, his activist life, he came under the radar of the government. You mentioned New York City Police, but early on, the FBI was aware of him. How early did they begin to take attention of Malcolm X and his activity?
They looked into him very early. I mean, he first came to national attention of the intelligence community actually while he was in prison, when he wrote a letter to the president about the draft and about World War II. And they filed that, and it's still on file. I think that's as early as the late 40s, because I believe he wrote it to Truman. It was after he got out of prison, when he began working jobs in Lansing, where he was living, or the Detroit area, where he was living with his family, where they first paid a visit to him, and the FBI would pay a number of visits to him over the year, in addition to keeping what ended up being voluminous files. He was very heavily investigated. His phones were tapped by the NYPD, and he seems to have been followed even to Africa by the CIA. So they were very interested in Malcolm for his entire life, beginning quite early after his release from prison, when he was just a junior minister in the Nation of Islam.
We're speaking this morning about Malcolm X and the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. Our guest this morning is Kevin Dalton, who is an editor at Viking Penguin. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And let's talk to Mark. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning, folks. Thanks for the great program. In the Oregonian, a paper I don't respect, a couple of days ago, they had some article about how Malcolm X's daughters had not read the book, but they were never interviewed by Manning Marable and had issues with some of the stuff he had said. So my two questions are, one is that true, or why wouldn't Manning Marable interview Malcolm's kids? And the other one is this part of a disinformation campaign to discredit the book?
Well, it's a complicated question. You know, In terms of Malcolm's daughters, the oldest one was I believe 7 years old when he died. And in terms of putting together his life and figuring out the best way to present as realistic a portrait of his life as possible, the number of people that Manning talked to about this book are remarkable. He talked to pretty much all of Malcolm's closest associates who were still alive at the time. He spoke to people who were wiretapping Malcolm from the NYPD for the last few years of his life. I mean, in terms of putting together this picture, he really did sort of reach out and talk to as many people as possible. As to the particulars of Manning and Manning's relationship with the family, I don't know enough to discuss it, but it's unfortunate. I know we feel that it's unfortunate. I'm sure that Manning would have felt it was unfortunate that they were unhappy with the book. As I've tried to sort of communicate, his goal here was never to diminish Malcolm. It was always to enlarge him, and I think that's something he's really succeeded at.
And with respect to why that article would have even been, to me it almost seems like the FBI is still after Malcolm in a sense.
I certainly can't speak to that, but I will say this. There are, in terms of the many Freedom of Information Request acts that Manning filed with the federal government, in terms of the NYPD files he found, there are still many, many government files about Malcolm X that have not been declassified. And so I think that definitely speaks to something along the lines of what you're asking.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Andrea.
Hi. I was just wondering whether there was any new information about his death, about the assassination, about the conspiracy theories that surrounded that.
Sure. Well, the interesting thing about the way that Manning frames the assassination is that it emerges as a kind of convergence of interests of a number of different groups. As Manning tells it, by 1965, the Nation of Islam had come to see Malcolm as a threat to its very existence. He had separated from them. He was still denouncing their leader, Elijah Muhammad, in the press. And it was at that time that the organization was also growing more and more violent in an attempt to police its own members. At the same time, Malcolm had, in 1964, spent months in Africa trying to get the civil rights issues that were shaking the United States to be recognized as human rights issues. And the U.S. government, as I sort of alluded to with the previous caller, was trying to block him at every turn. So when Malcolm managed to get Kenya to support, pass a resolution of support, it became that much more clear that he could pose trouble to the U.S. government. So when it comes to his assassination, I think what Manning tries to put together here is that the Nation of Islam, the U.S. intelligence community, and the NYPD were all very much at ease with Malcolm being silenced. And as I believe one of the police detectives that Manning interviewed said, they created a kind of atmosphere in which an assassination was going to happen. Mm. It's chilling.
Very chilling. Well, you know, the thing is you've got a black man who is traveling not just to sub-Saharan Africa, which in many people's mind might be quote-unquote expected, but you have a black man who is also traveling in the Arab nations as well and creating a strong alliance that could lead to a pan-African collaboration that would stretch not only to the United States, but also other countries of the African diaspora. And so to fear him is logical. It's unfortunate, but it's logical.
I mean, I completely agree with you. In terms of the range, in terms of the number of countries that he visited, the number of places where he was welcomed and just received with great warmth by government officials in the Middle East and Africa, it was remarkable. It was remarkable what he was able to do, especially after he had left the Nation of Islam, and he didn't have the support of an organization. He had his own two fledgling organizations in New York. And was still just being given a hero's welcome overseas in almost every place he visited. And I think that certainly got some people's hackles up in the government as the files show.
Well, let's just take a really brief moment and talk about his conversion from the Nation of Islam.
And related to that conversion from the Nation of Islam, could you explain, because it maybe in the autobiography you might get a sense that it was like an awakening, but from Mr. Marable's book, it seems at least there was an ongoing distancing between Malcolm and the Nation of Islam started
right.
early on, and just right. in terms of his approach towards society and political activism
yeah.
by default.
Sure. No, it's you're certainly right about that. I mean, it was even in the late 50s, you can see the seeds of what would be by the fall of 1963, early 1964, of what would be the split between Malcolm and the Nation of Islam. And a part of it had to do with the fact that the Nation was in its very nature apolitical. They didn't think that it was worth it for its members to vote. They didn't want its members protesting. They didn't support or encourage political activism. And Malcolm, as he emerged as a leader of people, began to see the frustrations inherent in that position. And he began to believe that it was only through political agitation that he could find the kinds of change and that the communities that he was leading could find the kind of change that would make life livable in a way that it previously hadn't been. And so by the time that he is splitting from the Nation in 1963, he is already in some ways light years ahead of them in terms of what he's trying to put together. The Nation certainly practiced some tenets of Islam, but they were not. There were things that they did differently in the way that they prayed, in certain different elements of the religion. And Malcolm was interested in finding the true nature of Orthodox Islam. And so, on a level of pure a sort of expression of religion and of a belief system, he and the Nation of Islam had definitely grown at odds. Now, there was a layer sort of underpinning that as well, which is that by the early 1960s, Malcolm had discovered that Elijah Muhammad, the head of the Nation of Islam, the man that in many ways he had come to look to as a kind of father figure since he had been released from prison in the early 50s, had been having illicit relationships with a number of Nation of Islam secretaries. And one of the people that he found that Elijah Muhammad had impregnated was a woman that Malcolm had loved since he was a teenager, someone he had known since he had been in Boston and sort of running around in his younger days. And this really devastated him, and it provides a new layer of looking at exactly what it was that drove his split between the Nation of Islam. I think on some level, he had just outgrown them. He had major political and spiritual differences. And then there was this personal element underpinning it as well. And I think that this is what made that split so tumultuous and difficult for him in early 1964.
Kevin, would it be fair to say, just to kind of flesh it out for folks who maybe are not as familiar with Malcolm, to say that it was inevitable that there was going to be a doctrinal split, because Malcolm had his roots in his parents following Marcus Garvey.
Absolutely.
And so he had a stronger sense of the capabilities of a Pan-African alliance. He understood the need for an engaged populace when it comes time to making decisions about the welfare of a people, both in terms of economics and political and social power. So he had a much richer foundation in terms of conceiving an instrument of social change. And so in terms of doctrine, he had already outgrown them before he even knew them.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And to sort of add to that, everything that he did in the Nation of Islam ultimately ended up contributing to that sense of him sort of emerging beyond their limits. Even as early as 1957, in the scene that Spike Lee sort of made so famous in the film of a brother in the Nation of Islam being beaten by the police, and Malcolm marching these columns of Nation of Islam members out to stand in front of the police station in protest, and ultimately then being able to get the man who'd been beaten out of jail and get him the care that he needed. He saw from pretty early on that action was necessary, and the Nation was not an action-oriented group, and ultimately that was never going to be a fit that would allow him to be the figure that he wanted to become.
Go ahead, Cecil.
No, I was just going to mention that, you know, you mentioned that scene from Spike Lee's film. I thought that was something that Mr. Lee, you know, took some dramatic license, but apparently from Mr. Marable's book, that was a historical incident.
And even the statement with regard to no man should have that much power, no one man.
Yeah, no, that's an actual quote. And then there was one of the incidents that really crystallized this for Malcolm was in 1962. Malcolm had previously set up the Nation of Islam Mosque in Los Angeles, and so he knew all the officials there. He was very invested in it. And there was an incident in which the police seemed to have attacked or pressed the Nation of Islam members who were selling clothing in the parking lot. Things sort of broke into a conflagration, and a member of the Nation of Islam was killed, a secretary, Ronald Stokes, secretary of the Los Angeles Mosque. And other members were beaten and imprisoned and ultimately went on trial. And when Malcolm found out about this, he was furious. And one of the things in this book that is still a chapter that when I go back through it, it gives me chills in a sense, because it makes for such dramatic reading. When Malcolm found out, he was ready to put together a squad,
yes,
to go out of
squad.
Members from New York to go out to Los Angeles and avenge the death of this member. And Elijah Muhammad told him to stand down. He said, "No, we're not doing this. We're not getting involved." And it was hard for Malcolm to listen to, because the idea behind the Nation of Islam and what Elijah Muhammad has always told him is that we're a coiled fist, we're ready to strike. And Malcolm said, "Well, this is the time for action." And even when it wasn't in a squad that he was putting together to go out there, it was something else. He began agitating. He began trying to press the police in the public arena. And then Elijah Muhammad told him to stand down from that as well. And it was this sense of being handcuffed when he felt that action was the only logical response that I think begins in the fall of 1962. It just begins to speed up what would eventually be the split.
Can we talk now, just briefly, because we're running out of time here,
sure,
about the trip to Africa, his Mecca, his Hajj, and how he grew even more to have a broader view of humanity and Africa's role in the world.
Sure. I mean, well, Malcolm, the interesting thing about Malcolm and the Hajj is that Malcolm made three separate trips to the Middle East and Africa in his life. The first was in 1959 when Nasser, the president of Egypt, reached out to Elijah Muhammad and invited him to come to Egypt and to make a pilgrimage. And Elijah Muhammad sent Malcolm ahead to make contacts in advance. And that was the first trip. And this is the one that just sort of transforms him in a way. And he is constantly waiting and just never has the chance because of just the business of his life to get back. And he doesn't have a chance until 1964. To get back to the Middle East, which is when he actually makes his pilgrimage. And in the letters that he wrote back to people here, it became very clear that something was changing with Malcolm, that he was beginning to have, you know, I think it's unfair to say that he was moving towards king, but he was beginning to rethink in terms of his ideas about race and his ideas about how to change the system. He was beginning to have a more inclusionary idea of changing the system. And this definitely scared some of his followers. I mean, James 67X, who is his right-hand man, says in the book that, you know, there was times where he was afraid to open Malcolm's letters from the Middle East because it just seemed to be, he seemed to be changing so quickly in terms of the people that he met and the communities that he was seeing and how he was received. All these things were changing what he was going to do when he got back.
The change that occurs within Malcolm X's life were radical and to some people, opinion swift in many ways. The subtitle of this book is A Life of Reinvention. Your reflection in terms of Malcolm's development, how much was it conscious reinvention, or how much was it much more generic or something change happening to him rather than consciously changing his approach?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, to begin with, Malcolm was such a charismatic individual that he was able to present himself differently to different crowds. He had that great ability of being able to talk to people and to get them to connect with him no matter what he was saying, which is why at times you see that he is embracing civil rights leaders and then 3 days later, you know, he's talking down about them. So he's not inconsistent in his way, though. It's all part of something broader. So I do think that from a certain standpoint, these were thoughtful reinventions, and they were things that he invested energy into. On the other hand, you know, he's someone who grew a tremendous intellectual distance in 40 years of living. And I think that you couldn't say that part of who he was and the changes that occurred to him were not part of sort of the environments that were around him, whether it was being in prison and needing to find an identity that was defined in opposition to being a number or being a prisoner, or whether it was being a minister and ultimately then leaving the group that had formed a lot of his adult identity and finding something beyond that. I mean, there were at the same time a conscious decision to move beyond what he had been, and there was just a reaction to events that were happening around him. The more he learned, the more he read, the more he thought about things, the more these things changed who he was.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking this morning with Kevin Dalton, who is an editor at Vike and Penguin, about the new books, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. And let's go to our final caller, I think, maybe, Michael. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I read about his Malcolm X book. I just wanted to say that what produced Malcolm X was the criminal justice system. Because when he went into prison, back in them days, even today, the criminal justice system is what is producing militants and radicals. George Jackson and Angela Davis and all those people, that's what the prison system produced. And so I don't think Malcolm, when he gravitated to the black Muslims, Muslims, he gravitated to, at first to the political aspect, not the religious aspect. And in the beginning, I think he just wanted to hurt somebody. Later on, I think he converted over to the religious part. But you need to definitely look at the prison system as probably the most instrumental force in America that produced Malcolm X. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's certainly. I mean, when you look at this, is the prison that Malcolm was sent to was a notoriously just terrible place in Massachusetts, and it was the place where Sacco and Vanzetti had been executed. It was just a big, old, horrible, dirty building, and I mean, there's definitely something to be said about what happened to Malcolm in prison and how it changed him, and in a way. He was fortunate to find the people that he did, and maybe he had reached a place where he was ready to look to someone like Bembry, who was the man who he first began to admire in prison, a man who seemed to be able to speak on any different topic and who eventually became a tutor for Malcolm and got him reading all of the greats. I mean, there are any number of different ways in which you could have emerged from a prison like that, and many people probably didn't emerge from a prison like that, but it makes Malcolm all the more remarkable, I think, that he was able to go from that environment to becoming the person he became.
I don't want to diminish, though. I mean, prison, yes, did have its effects, but prison sometimes it serves as a crucible. You know, it will reduce a person to what's already there.
Yes.
More often than not. And with regard to folks like Angela Davis, well, we're talking about somebody who was destined to be an academician regardless, you know. And so with respect to Malcolm, not only, again, and I want to bring up his family history of being Garveyites, did he have exposure to sound political and social doctrine? He had that strong tie of family, which you alluded to earlier in our conversation, which also shaped him and led him more so than anger to not only hook up with a man of learning who is Bembe, as he called him, you know, but his pursuit of knowledge later.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think it's a number of different factors. When you look at Malcolm's grades from the time he was in school,
yes, he was bright.
He was always a smart young man.
Yeah, wanted to be a lawyer. Mm-hmm.
It was always there. It was always there, just waiting, in some sense, for him to shape it and for it to be shaped by what was around him.
Yes.
We want to thank you, Kevin, for joining us this morning and for working with Mr. Marabou on this great book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a privilege to speak with you and your listeners, and it was always a privilege to work with Manning Marable on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. And you are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.